Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. I'm your host, Shanna Fold, and I'm here to get you caught up quickly. I've got some news stories for you today from Israel, and guess what? You're listening, so you're already on top of your game. Survive and thrive, people. Knowledge is the best weapon. Today is Wednesday, July 1st, 2026 in the Gregorian calendar and the 16th of Tammuz, 5786 in the Hebrew calendar. Now, let's get to the news. Iran says technical talks with the United States and Qatar have wrapped up, with both sides agreeing to partially release billions of dollars in frozen Iranian funds for approved purchases. U.S. officials argue that Iran stands to gain far more by sticking to the memorandum of understanding than by disrupting shipping or charging tolls in the Strait of Hormuz as negotiations toward a broader agreement continue. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Technocratic Committee, expected to eventually administer Gaza, says it held productive meetings in Cyprus as it prepares for a future transition away from Hamas rule, though no timeline has been announced. That's from Reuters, so we'll need to keep an update on that. Gadi Eisenkot officially launched his centrist Yeshar Party campaign this week, aiming straight at Israel's working middle class, the commuters, parents, reservists, and families who feel the country needs steadier leadership. Eisenkot is running under the weight of personal loss. His son, Master Sergeant Gal Meir Eisenkot, was killed fighting in Gaza on December 7th, 2023. That's exactly 2 months after the October 7th massacre. And we at Tribe Tel Aviv, the organization for internationals in Israel that I run, got a closer look tonight. I just came in from hosting a program for the internationals. We did a program with the Yeshar Party founder Inbar Harush Gitti for an intimate English language conversation with young internationals who are learning about the party. Now, we're doing a political series in English to help people get in front of the different parties. Here in Israel, you vote for parties, not people, even if you like the person who's the number one seat in that party. The series is on. Today was our third installment. And by the way, this is the first English language event that the Yeshar Party had at all. And they chose us to host it. The Yeshar Party says that it stands for responsible leadership, national unity, orthodox enlistment to the service, and public service for Arab Israelis who don't want to join the army. Now, currently, if you're an Israeli army, an Israeli Arab, you don't have to join the army. You can volunteer, and many do. It's definitely considered a rite of passage here in Israel, but there's also something called Shirut Leumi, national service. And so the idea from the Yeshar Party is that the Arab Israeli citizens would, if they don't want to go to the army, have to do national service. And that could be at schools, at hospitals, at police stations. They say that they care about security and rebuilding trust in the state of Israel. They say their team is full of high quality, experienced professionals. Tonight at the program, Harush Gitti and her team blamed Netanyahu and his administration for creating a rift with the United States, saying they reduced funding and access for lower level diplomats and government workers who previously had been engaged in Israel-U.S. relationship management. They basically stated that, and you know, I haven't checked and if this is true, but they said that there were a lot of lower level individuals in Israel's government that were working to manage those relationships and that they were basically dismissed or pushed out or not funded. And so they believe that a lot of those smaller level interactions were not happening between the U.S. and Israel and that it was only happening at the top. House Republicans blocked a vote on an amendment that would have removed a new U.S.-Israel Defense Technology Cooperation Initiative from the annual defense spending bill. California Congressman Ro Khanna criticized the move, saying that lawmakers were denied the opportunity to debate and vote on this proposal. Basically, the Republicans said that this is not going to be up for debate. That's what happened. that this cooperation between the U.S. and Israel was not going to be up for debate. The amendment targeted expanding military cooperation between the U.S. and Israel, not existing American military aid. The dispute highlights the growing divide in Washington over U.S. policy toward Israel and continued cooperation between the armies. Colorado Democrat Melat Quiroz has won her congressional primary after campaigning on a platform that includes an arms embargo against Israel. Quiroz is a Democratic socialist who's previously described the October 7th Hamas attack as a consequence of Israeli policy and has argued that calling for the end of Israel is not anti-Semitic. The 29-year-old Democrat, whose platform focused on complete arms embargo for Israel, won her primary on Tuesday. She's now slated to become the first female Gen Z member of Congress and will join a slew of other progressives whose campaigns focused on changing the U.S.-Israel relationship. That's what they focused on. Quiroz has long been outspoken on her lack of support for Israel, calling October 7th, quote, the inevitable consequence of apartheid, and was fired from her position at a New York law firm after posting a letter in which she argued that the elimination of the state of Israel is not anti-Semitic. Her victory in Congress is raising more concerns among Colorado's Jewish community, who question whether she'll represent their interests. Quiroz now advances to the general election in a heavily Democratic district. This comes after similar victories for Democratic socialists in New York City last week rocked the Jewish world. Israel is marking 12 years since the bodies of Gilad Shaar, Naftali Frankel, and Eyal Ifra were found near Hebron after they were kidnapped and murdered by Hamas terrorists who picked them up on the side of the road while they were trying to hitchhike a ride home from yeshiva. Their abduction launched one of the largest search operations in Israeli history and led to Operation Brothers Keeper in the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, depending on what you call it. Days later, fighting escalated into Operation Protective Edge in Gaza. More than a decade later, these three teenagers remain symbols of national unity and of Israel's most painful tragedy. Of course, one of the most painful tragedies. Israel has been through so many painful tragedies, especially most recently the October 7th massacre, which killed 1,200 and kidnapped 250, and certainly not all of them came home alive. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff briefed lawmakers this week on the new memorandum of understanding between Washington and Tehran. Administration officials say the agreement is designed to lead to a final deal that would limit Iran's nuclear program, with negotiations continuing in Qatar. Like we shared up at the top of the show, Democratic lawmakers criticized the briefing, arguing that this agreement would give Iran greater economic leverage without enough security guarantees. Like I said at the top of the show, that's already happening. The administration responded and said that sanctions relief will not take effect until and unless a final agreement is reached, which has not happened yet. For more on this, we have our political analyst, Binyamin Moalem. Moalem is deeply engaged in Israeli current events and policy discussions. Having worked as a foreign law clerk at the Supreme Court of Israel, he's got a unique vantage point on Israeli jurisprudence. Binyamin devotes much of his time to curating and explaining current events and politics in Israel on his popular Instagram page, By Moalem, where he provides balanced news coverage from an Israeli perspective. Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast, Binyamin Moalem. Thanks for joining us today.
Good to be back with you, Shana.
So we are in some interesting times. I want to call it a lull, but it's not really a lull because the conversation does continue to move with Iran and the United States. Give us the latest on where things stand between the United States, Iran, and Israel and Lebanon, as we have a MOU, a memorandum of understanding between the United States and Iran, and it's kind of an interim time, right? So we had about 2 months to move forward to a more finalized version of this deal. Please tell us where we're at today.
Okay, so a lot has happened over the past week, both on the Lebanon arena. Israel and Lebanon signed an agreement last Friday, and the U.S. and Iran appears to be in a bit of a stalemate. So let's back up. 2 weeks ago, we had the MOU signed between the U.S. and Iran. Under the terms of those of that MOU, again, there wasn't a lot that we know about, because it was basically, here's what we're going to discuss over the next 2 months so that we can reach a more permanent deal. So one of the biggest things for Israel was not just the fact that Iran was getting something in exchange for a pledge to discuss their nuclear program, mainly the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, the ability to export their oil, but also the leverage that Iran exercised on Lebanon, basically saying, listen, you want to talk to us, to the United States, then you need to get Israel out of Lebanon. You need to force a ceasefire in Lebanon, even though Israel was not done battling Hezbollah. Now, what has happened since then was Israel and Lebanon, which have been in bilateral negotiations over the past few months, they've had a few rounds of talks. They reached a deal last Friday. And again, it bears mentioning that Israel wasn't the only side that was upset at the fact that the U.S. allowed Iran to exercise its leverage on Lebanon. Lebanon was as well. Now, keep in mind that the majority of the Lebanese people, they want Hezbollah out. They don't want Iran putting its influence into Lebanon. They believe that's what's causing the destruction of the country because of these wars between Hezbollah and Israel. And the government led by President Joseph Aoun, he's Christian. The Prime Minister, Nawaf Salem, he's Sunni. They are against Hezbollah. The Speaker of Lebanon's Parliament, Nabi Berri, he is Shiite. He is considered an ally of Hezbollah. He is against the deal. In any event, the government negotiated this deal with Israel at the ambassadorial level. The ambassador to the U.S., Lebanon's ambassador to the U.S., and Israel's ambassador to the U.S. negotiated this deal that was brokered by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And basically, under the terms of this deal, very significant for Israel, the deal says that Israel can remain in southern Lebanon in its security zone until Hezbollah is disarmed. Now, this really takes the wind out of whatever leverage Iran was trying to impose on the situation in Lebanon, because Iran was saying, listen, we're standing up for Lebanese rights, even though they're really just standing up for Hezbollah, which is their proxy in Lebanon that sits on the border with Israel. And so we want Israel out, and that way you'll talk to us. Lebanon said, no, we want Iran out. And they basically gave Israel a green light. This was part of a confidential annex. Lebanon does not want to publicly say that they are allowing Israel to remain in southern Lebanon. But basically they said, we want Hezbollah out. And obviously Lebanon cannot do it alone. They tried between the end of 2024 and the beginning of 2026 and failed. Also, Israel gave them the opportunity. Recently, there's this big tunnel network in southern Lebanon that Israel currently has surrounded. Several dozen Hezbollah operatives are believed to be trapped there. Israel said to Lebanon, hey, do you guys want this opportunity to take care of this? They said, no, you guys do it. So Israel is withdrawing from two small areas in the security zone in favor of Lebanon as a pilot. Israel has cleared these areas of Hezbollah infrastructure and Hezbollah terrorists, and basically telling Lebanon, here's your opportunity. Come into these areas and keep them secure. Keep Hezbollah from coming back. Keep Hezbollah from rebuilding itself in these areas. And if this works, then we'll start withdrawing from other areas in southern Lebanon in the security zone. And this was agreed to by the Lebanese government. So the message here is, both by Lebanon and by Israel and by the United States — the United States is a signatory to this deal as well — is basically, hey, Iran, you guys want Israel out for in exchange for a deal? Well, that's not happening, because Lebanon, the party you're claiming to be speaking on behalf of, they don't want what you guys want. They want what they want, and they want Hezbollah out. So this was the prime minister called this a major blow to Iran. And this was after Israel got what many saw to be a huge loss during the MOU, where Iran basically successfully exercised leverage on Israel, meaning with the United States against Israel. This was Israel kind of using that leverage and throwing it right back at Iran. And which allows Israel to remain in South Lebanon. Since then, over the weekend, we had a bit of a tit for tat between the United States and Iran. Iran is trying to enforce, to flex its muscles in the Strait of Hormuz. And what they did was, they are basically saying, right now they said, you know, we're allowing ships to go through without paying anything, but they're saying we're going to make everybody pay at the end of this 60-day ceasefire, which is August 18th, I believe, with the United States saying no deal is going to allow Iran to charge any tolls in the Strait of Hormuz. It's going to go back to being free passage for all ships. But Iran is saying all ships need to coordinate with us. They need to clear, get our permission to traverse. Now, a lot of ships weren't doing this. A lot of ships were going through the southern part of the Strait of Hormuz, which is in Omani waters. And so Iran fired a drone at one of these ships and struck the ship. Now, I don't think anybody was injured, but it damaged the ship. In response, the U.S. bombed a drone depot in southern Iran. Iran then went ahead and fired another drone at another ship the following day. This was on Saturday, I believe. Then the U.S. went ahead and bombed several more targets in Iran. Iran responded by bombing U.S. targets in Bahrain and Kuwait. And then they again agreed to resume the ceasefire and conduct talks, at least according to the U.S., to conduct talks this week in Qatar. Now, Jared Kushner, Steve Witkoff, the U.S. envoys, went to Qatar to engage in these talks. Iran said, no, we never agreed to resume any talks. The U.S. needs to abide by the terms of the MOU. The U.S. is not abiding by the terms of the MOU. We're not sitting down with the United
States. And why does Iran say that the U.S. is not abiding by the terms of the MOU?
Iran wants clear indications that, number one, the Strait of Hormuz is theirs. The U.S. is saying absolutely not. They claim that the MOU says that eventually Iran will get its sovereignty, meaning they want all of their preconditions checked off before they will even engage in nuclear talks. The U.S. is under the impression that this MOU was like, okay, we discussed these things. Now we're going to talk about the MOU. We're going to talk about the nuclear deal, which is the main point of this whole MOU. Iran is saying, no, the main point of the whole MOU is reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, unfreezing of all our assets, meaning they want to get their money. They want to get the Strait of Hormuz sorted out. They want Israel out of Lebanon. And then they'll talk about, and they said repeatedly that until Israel withdraws from Lebanon or the Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon is part of some sort of deal, we are not even going to engage in nuclear talks. So I don't know. It seems very, very clear that there is almost no way, barring some sort of miracle, there will be a deal, a comprehensive deal by the August 18th deadline. Now, President Trump in a Wall Street Journal report this morning, he was briefed on some options of resuming the war and quote unquote finishing the job in Iran. He said he wants to give diplomacy a chance. He said he's okay with the talks extending beyond the August 18th deadline. And again, the MOU does allow for extensions if a deal is not reached by then, so long as negotiations are ongoing. But it does not appear that Iran's red lines are anywhere close to the U.S. red lines on pretty much any of these issues, whether it's the nuclear deal, which they haven't even discussed yet, whether it's the Strait of Hormuz, whether it's Lebanon. And right now, Iran has gotten sanctions partially lifted, meaning on its oil exports, in exchange for reopening the Strait of Hormuz, which many saw in the beginning and many still do see as a major loss for the U.S. Because the U.S. basically gave Iran something in exchange for a pledge to engage in talks. Now, one thought that I had, you know, when a couple of weeks ago, when everybody was talking about like what is President Trump thinking, and this was not just in Israel but also in the U.S. You had critics for the deal on both sides of the political aisle, both on among the Republicans and among the Democrats. And one thought that I had, which appears to be a real possibility as we see this play out over the past 2 weeks, is that President Trump had two major concerns coming into these talks. Right, number one is skyrocketing oil prices. Right, United States Americans don't like to pay a lot for gas, even though the U.S. pays a lot less than Europeans, a lot less than Israelis do. It's still $4 gas prices is unacceptable in the United States. Another thing that President Trump has coming up is the midterm elections, and he cannot be seen, you know, engaged in a war that many might feel like he's going against his word on, getting into never-ending Middle Eastern wars just ahead of a midterm election where his majority in Congress is at stake. So perhaps what President Trump is trying to do here, and again, this is just my own thoughts. I have no insider information into what's going on in the Trump administration, or certainly not what's going on in Trump's head, but President Trump wants to flood the market with oil. By reopening the Strait of Hormuz and dropping sanctions on oil exports in Iran, he is going to flood global oil markets with oil, thus driving down the price of oil. And that has happened over the past 2 weeks. Oil prices are now lower than they were before the war even began. So not only is oil from Gulf states getting out of the Strait of Hormuz, Iranian oil, which until now has been banned from the global oil markets, except, you know, only China was buying those oil, is now open to everybody. And while Iran is getting money as a result of this, the Trump administration might see that as a, so to speak, a drop in the bucket compared to what, compared to the economic damage that it sustained because of the sanctions, because years of sanctions, because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz over the course of the 2 months prior, and because of the war. So whereas the Iranian economy sustained losses of hundreds of billions of dollars, they're now going to be getting billions of dollars for a limited period of time while the global market gets flooded with oil. And once this period, this 2 month ceasefire period ends, President Trump may be thinking like, I'll extend it. You know, I could extend it for September, October, no, 3 more months, get past the midterm elections, and then I can go back to war if there is no deal with Iran, which appears that the red lines on both sides, that that's barring some sort of miracle or big change in heart on one side or the other, I don't see how a deal happens. Another thing that's interesting here is that J.D. Vance, the vice president, has really been at the forefront of the Iran negotiations. He went to the first round of talks last week in Switzerland. He's been doing the media circuit, talking about the importance and what he's trying to accomplish on that end. Whereas Marco Rubio, the national security advisor and the secretary of state, he's been brokering this Israel-Lebanon agreement. It's kind of interesting to see this dynamic. Now, again, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but these are the two people who are considered the two top front runners for the 2028 Republican nomination. And each one is probably going to want to tout their foreign policy wins over the course of the successes over the 4 years prior to the 2028 election. So if one of them is successful and one of them is not, that'll give a boost to one of their potential campaigns, if and when that does happen. So something to keep an eye on. President Trump even hinted, you know, when he touted the Iran deal, he's like, JD is taking care of this, and if it doesn't work out, well, I'll blame him. He said that in joking, but maybe only half joking. This way Trump can kind of separate himself. Whatever the case, it seems that Trump is trying to, at the very least, get oil prices down. He has succeeded in that. Try to get this issue off of his plate ahead of the midterms. We'll see if that does work out. Again, the midterms are still several months away, but he will leave the option open to resuming the war once the midterms are over, and he no longer has to worry about, you know, how the war looks at the ballot box, at least not for a couple of years after that. So just something that I thought could be something that's going on in his head, because, you know, for somebody who touts himself as a master negotiator, this does not seem like the greatest negotiation, at least not from an Israeli perspective, certainly not from an Israeli perspective, and for many in the United States as well. You know, critics on both sides of the political aisle have expressed their doubts about this deal. Perhaps President Trump is playing a longer game than we think.
Thank you, Benjamin, for breaking that down for us. And, you know, I was going to ask you to send us off with what you think is going to happen next, but you already covered it.
I don't know that I think that's what's going to happen, but I think that's a possibility of what could happen.
We know.
As of now, I don't see how a final deal is negotiated unless the U.S. really caves or Iran really caves.
Well, thank you so much for getting us caught up, and we'll talk to you soon. We'll have you back next week.
Thank you very much, Anna. Have a good one.
You too. And now for a Torah thought by Rabbi Yossi Madvig of Oswego, New York.
In this week's Torah portion, Pinchas, the grandson of Aaron, the high priest, gets a special covenant to become a Kohen, a priest, because of the bravery and zealousness for God he showed in last week's Parsha when he stood up to the leader of the tribe of Shimon, who was engaged in immoral activity which caused a plague. This zeal, repeated hundreds of years later by the prophet Elijah, who stood up to the false prophets of Baal and almost lost his life at the hands of Queen Jezebel. It was this zealotry that gave Elijah the merit to be the one to herald the coming of Mashiach, the Messiah. In fact, the sages teach that Pinchas is Elijah, meaning that they share the same soul. Just as the zeal of Pinchas saved the Jews in the desert, so too Elijah will be vindicated with the final redemption. However, according to some, Elijah didn't live up to his full potential. He complained to God that the Jews were not fulfilling the Torah, especially the worship of idols, and abrogating the covenant of circumcision. So, he is told to go in a cave and receive a prophecy. It is taught that this is the place where Moses went after the sin of the golden calf. Instead of pleading for the people as Moses did, Elijah complains and wants the Jews punished. So he is told that he must anoint a new king and a new prophet to replace him. Not only that, but he's told of the thousands that were following the Torah. And this is why he is also, according to Jewish tradition, present at every circumcision and Passover Seder, to witness the fact that throughout the generations, Jews are faithful to the covenant of God. And while there may be some who fall away, as a whole, the Jewish people are God's people. They will never abandon him, and more importantly, God will never abandon them. Shabbat shalom.
All right. Well, that is it for today's show. Today is Wednesday, July 1st, 2026. Tel Aviv has a low of 25 degrees Celsius and a high of 28 degrees. That's 77 degrees Fahrenheit for the low, going up to 88 degrees for the high. We are everywhere. Don't forget to sign up to our Israel Weekly News Wrap. The Israel Weekly News Wrap is a newsletter with the top five stories coming out of Israel from throughout the week. And of course, with a personal note from me at the top, you can sign up for that at israeldailynews.org. Scroll down to the bottom and drop your email address in. A big thank you goes out to our incredible sponsor, Marianne Vollinger, our writer, Perry Schwartz, and our associate producer, Lori May, as well as our summer interns, Alex, Leah, and Hannah. I'll be away from Israel for a minute, spending some time with family. It is so important for me to spend time with my family. I'm here essentially on my own. My parents and my sisters are in the United States. I have an aunt and an uncle here and cousins, which is really great. But there is nothing like being with your immediate family. So I'll be with them for a bit. Keep an eye out for some cultural podcasts set to be released early next week and some adjustments to our episodes. They'll be a little bit different than what you're used to, but nevertheless, you'll have them. Have a great and productive day and an excellent weekend. Shabbat shalom, everyone.